Well, what do you think of our friend Cornelius? Seems all he thinks about is silver and gold.
Silver and gold, silver and gold. Everyone wishes for silver and gold. How do you measure its worth? Just by the pleasure it gives here on earth. Silver and gold, silver and gold, mean so much more when I see silver and gold decorations on every Christmas tree.
What's a Christmas tree without tinsel and pretty silver and gold decorations? Can't really call it a Christmas tree now, can you? And think of all the fun and joy that would be lost on Christmas morning if all the young folks didn't get to see that sparkling, happy tree.
Silver and gold, silver and gold, means so much.
Welcome to Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast, episode number 88. I'm your host, Jan Irvin. This episode is titled An Update with Steven Zarlenga, Part 4, and is being released on Tuesday, August 24, 2010. My interview with Steven Zarlenga was recorded on August 24, 2010. This is an update, part 4 of our series with Steven Zarlenga, looking deeper into the fundamental concepts of money. What is money, and how is it defined? What is the difference between money and credit? What is the history of money? And why is any of this important to you? And how could it possibly affect your life? Steven Zarlenga is the founder of the American Monetary Institute, AMI, the leading American monetary think tank for monetary history, theory, and reform. An economic historian and author, Zarlenga provides us the clearest picture of how money and monetary systems work in his incredible 2000-tome tome that was just republished in the last couple months, The Lost Science of Money. And he's also the author of the American Monetary Act, submitted to Congress by Denis Kucinich in March of last year. And if you've not already read his book, it's an absolute must-read. And you can find out more about Steve and order his book from www.monetary.org. Donations this week, my love and thanks goes out to Aaron, Randy, James, Jeremy, Kurzistoff, Daniel, and Cody. This show is run on donations and our website sales. This is not corporate media, but truly independent media. And without your support, we wouldn't be here. And I still have one transcript left if you can help with that. That's with Dave Nichols. And please contact me at contact@gnosticmedia.com if you can help with that. And regarding the upcoming shows, as I've said the last couple of weeks, things have been stressful lately, and I've just been putting the shows out as I can instead of on the regular Monday schedule. Upcoming guests next week will be Dr. Marguerite Riegel-Yozo, and I'm doing my very best to get Hank Alberelli on the week after that. And still putting out the MAPS talks, so I will get one of those out as soon as possible. And the views expressed by the authors and guests of this program are their own and are not necessarily those held by myself, the host, or Gnostic Media. The website, www.gnosticmedia.com. That's G-N-O-S-T-I-C media.com. And once again, contact me at contact@gnosticmedia.com. Thanks for listening, and thank you for your support.
Hey, how are you?
Good. How are you?
Well, I'm really good for one reason, anyway. And of which we'll talk about. And that is that are you recording now?
I'm recording, Steve.
Oh, okay.
Go right ahead. Well, you know, and I guess, you know, my audience is probably for the most part familiar with who you are, but
okay.
Welcome back for your
Well,
fourth
why don't you
time.
Tell them, just in case there's some, you're getting new people calling, you know, onto your audience. Go ahead, introduce me.
I'm here with Steven Zarlenga of the American Monetary Institute. And Steve, welcome back for your...
Thank you, Jan. It's great to be here.
You're quite welcome, and this is your fourth time here, so
wow.
Let me ask you a good starting point question.
Okay.
Can you claim to understand money without understanding what the definition of money is in the first place?
How? If you don't understand the concept of money, how can you go beyond that? One of the key things in reading the various source materials that I had to consult in order and read in order to first to understand the subject, and that was after a lifetime working in the financial planning area. One of the key things that I always look for in reading an author was, did they understand the nature of money, or were they operating under a commodity view, first simple mistake, or credit view of money as credit, the way we now define it in America. Were they operating under that, or did they have an inkling, at least an inkling, of the Aristotelian view, the correct view of money? Money exists not by nature, but by law. Money is a creation of society. It's a legal power, a legal societal power. Once you understand that, you have a chance to understand what's going on and to figure out what to do. Now, the Austrian school, you see, is hopelessly mired. Oh, and some of them might be listening or might tune in, because some of them actually attacked one of my shows with you, and so they may tune in, which would be good. There, some of them are open, you know, to hearing reality, and others who look at it more as a kind of gang warfare, their gang against everybody else, they're never open. But with the Austrians, their concept of money as an economic good, and most of them like gold and silver, but that concept of money leads you into horrible errors. For example, the Austrians, with that concept of money, it's impossible to figure out how to solve our current crisis problem, for the simple reason that it's not easy to bring economic goods into existence, especially when you don't have money to do it and to fund and oil the machinery that we do have. We've got the machinery, we've got the people who are ready and willing to produce and work, we've got the resources that we can get a hold of, we've got a lot of idle machinery. We've got the ability to do these things. We don't have the money to do them. And with the Austrians, you can never get that, because one comes before the other. So the Austrians are hopelessly mired in a really unfortunate misdiagnosis of the nature of money. And this leads them to a misdiagnosis of everything. They think that it must collapse. Now, it may collapse. It may be probable that it's going to collapse because of the kind of stupidity going on, but it is not a foregone necessity, not by any means. We have within our power the ability to turn this around and to start it's going to take rebuilding, because there's been so much destruction by crazy people who have been put into the presidency by other people who I would not give the benefit of the doubt in calling them crazy. They are bad. You could call them evil, except maybe that gives them too much intelligence. You have to be intelligent to be that type of evil. But it's you know, for them to keep George Bush, a traitor to this country, a man who is identifiably an international war criminal, to keep him in the office of the presidency for 8 years. I'm not even going to mention that creature that they called his vice president. You know, that to me defines the true Republican leadership as despicable.
Why don't we go back to the building blocks and define the word money? What is money?
Well, let's start with Aristotle, because he gave us the science of money. Money exists not by nature, but by law. Okay. Now, what's that saying? He's telling us, he's differentiating between money and wealth. He's differentiating money is an abstract under our control. Now I'm hesitating here because I'm looking up the page in my book that does this, and I'll give it to you exactly, okay? We finally get to the real definition of money in chapter 24, and what I'll remind everybody what this book does. This book belongs in every American's permanent family library, and it'll be permanent. It's printed on 300-year paper, for starters. Everything about this, it's library binding, everything about it is the best that it's possible to get. And it's 736 pages, and we finally get to the concept of money, the definition of money, in the 24th chapter. Now, chapters 1 through 23 give the historical case studies, the various histories which help us to define money, because we can see what money is doing during those times. And so we have those as the first 23 chapters for a background to understand money. And then chapter 24 says very simply, all right, that's what we learn about money from the past. What should we be doing to the present system today in order to fix it, in order to get it right? And that's what's in chapter 24. By now, readers should now understand, this is page 656, readers should now understand what money is, what it is we're reforming. We've noted our inheritance from past genius. From Aristotle, money exists not by nature, but by law. From Plato, quote, a money token for purposes of exchange, unquote. From the Roman jurist Paulus, quote, this device, being officially promulgated, circulated, and maintained its purchasing power, not so much from its substance as from its quantity. Then, after a long darkness, from Berkeley, Bishop Berkeley of Coyne, Ireland, Anglican bishop, the Anglicans have an excellent monetary record, quote, whether the true idea of money as such be not altogether that of a ticket or counter. From Locke and Franklin, who viewed money as a pledge for wealth rather than wealth itself. Then the best is from Alexander Delmas, who wrote, what is commonly understood as money has always consisted tangibly of a number of pieces of some material marked by public authority and named or understood in the laws or customs that its palpable characteristic was its mark of authority. Its essential characteristic, the possession of value, defined by law, and its function, the legal power to pay debts and taxes, and the mechanical power to facilitate the exchange of other objects possessing value. And then from George Knapp, quote, our test that the money is accepted in payments to the state offices. Now, what I write then for the American Monetary Institute, we accept these concepts and add money's essence, apart from whatever is used to signify it, is an abstract social power embodied in law as an unconditional means of payment. That's money. Now, to truly understand that, your listeners should get this book. They really should.
How many pages did it take you to define money in your book?
Well, we didn't try until page 656. Because it's foolish to just put out a definition unless people know what to relate it to. You see?
I do.
And that's how I think people will learn. By having the definition clearly stated, but also having the case histories, which it applies to.
Well, wouldn't you have to have the case histories? Wouldn't you have to understand the history of money to understand what money is in the first place? I guess that's
so.
What we've been talking about. But yeah, I would think so too.
That's my view, and I think you see the. Various economic schools, the Austrians are among the worst, but they're not alone. They attempt to do everything by logic. And by concept definition, without experience attached to it. And then they try to work these things. To use Alexander Delmar's great statement, he said, quote, as a rule, political economists, that's what they used to call economists, political economists don't bother to study the history of money. It's much easier to, it's much easier to postulate it logically, and these are not, I'm paraphrasing, it's much easier to try to deduce the principles from this imaginary knowledge. In other words, they imagine what money is and then deduce from that, from those axioms, the various things that they think they know about money. Well, it's time for economists to start looking at reality. For example, the reality of what their bankers have done here to the whole world, following their silly concepts, their erroneous economic ideas, are at the bottom. It's not just theft, although that's important and a big part of what happened, very big part. It's also that the concepts of economics that they have, theft is defined into the system. It's inherent in the structure that they have created. And rather than simply trying to use logic, I'm suggesting that they have to look at the results of what they've done. And the results, over and over, their money and banking system has run society into the wall. We don't know how many people are dead as a result because of the wars that it engendered. We don't know how many civilians died because, thanks to the economics, they didn't have the money to buy new tires for their car, and they got a flat and ran off a cliff. We don't know how many people died because they could not get medical attention that everybody, that was available and should have been available to everybody. These are the real effects. We are dealing here with life and death, and these characters are sitting in universities, many, pretending to know something. I'm disgusted with it all. Now, I must say there are exceptions. There are good exceptions, and I can name a bunch right off the bat. There's the Gelbreth son. There's Nick Tiedemann at Virginia Tech. We do a lot of work with Michael Hudson. Stephen Kinn from Australia as well. There are a couple of handfuls of exceptions. Dean Baker. You know, there are some good guys out there. They're not getting the attention that they deserve. Neither are we.
Would you like to define nomisma?
Nomisma is the Greek word that Aristotle uses to identify money. Nomisma was their word, the word he uses for money. Now, this word is quite rare in Greek texts. It's not, you don't find it. You find it in Aristotle, and you have to look back 125 years before that, and you find it in Herodotus. But the Greek word for money was nomisma, one of the Greek words for money, and the Greek word for law or binding custom, which was the equivalent of law, was nomos, N-O-M-O-S. And it's demonstration of the closeness of money and law. And this is why gold went up so high under Bush. He destroyed law. And when you destroy law, you destroy not only, you know, you destroy the potential for real money. You must have a legal system to have money. People say, you're going to create another Mozambique. Well, you know, Mozambique has no law. They have no society. That's why their currency fell apart and will continue to until they can establish a society. Everything is falling apart there. You need to have a system of law. You need to have functioning relations between people. You need to have an infrastructure that is functioning. All of those things are needed in order to create a workable, fair money system. And when you're trying to do that, the key, absolute key thing through history, what we learn in all 23 chapters, is that it must never be privatized. That is the huge sin in all the world's money systems. They are privatized. Now, they are privatized worse over here than just about any place else, because almost every other country, at least the nation, owns the central bank. It doesn't do them much good because they allow the private banks to create money in the same way that they create money here. When they make loans, they're in the process of creating money. So the money power, which is the ability to create and regulate the amount of money out there, it's privatized here. And there's no evidence ever to show that a privatized money system can work. Never has. There are far better examples, and they're in my book. And this is another reason people who want to understand these things, they have to read about these examples. Far more reasons to understand that a government-run money system is superior, and not just in theory and logic, but in terms of actual results. And so it's important to gain this knowledge. One of our speakers at our upcoming conference, Coleridge, he's a Quaker, by the way, he's going to give a talk. He's from Cleveland. He's giving a talk on the necessity of unambiguous, careful research before embarking on any social reform movement. And he's going to explain to people why, unless you do that first, you end up nowhere. And that's what my book will help your readers and your listeners to do.
You have to have knowledge of what you're dealing with before you can understand it, and you have to understand it before you can impart wisdom to others.
Yeah, and get together with them to make the needed changes.
What is credit?
Credit is a promise, usually let's say in the terms of the banking, a promise to pay money. So when they're making a loan to you and all of a sudden the numbers show up in your checking account that they have put something in there that you can then use by writing checks, they haven't even put money in there. They put a credit in there. They put in a promise, their promise to pay money. I know that sounds technical and so on, but that's how screwed up our system is. And that money, using credit for money, will always collapse when the situation runs into difficulties. Credit evaporates in a crisis. Money does not. And so they have given us one crisis after another, usually every 50, 60 years. This one, the last really big one like this was the 1930s. So we're talking about, what, 80 years. Sometimes it's a bit less, 40. People used to think the Kondratiev wave meant something. Who knows? But regularly, a credit money system breaks down with dire consequences. And one of the consequences from the breakdown of the 1929, you can name them. One of them was Adolf Hitler and World War II. And whether that was, it was directly related to the financial collapse. Probably would not have occurred otherwise. So, what, 70 million died in that? 65 million people died in World War II?
Something like that, 63.
Yeah, yeah. That's the result of a poor money system. Now, we are the survivors.
So we may not be that harsh. Well, yeah, but we're here and we survived. You know what I mean? You can't judge the system just by the survivors when it's when its critics are underground.
What is debt?
The opposite side of credit. Somebody loans you something, they've given you a credit, and you have a debt to them. It's just the other side of the coin.
And can you borrow your way out of debt? Can you drink yourself sober?
Well, no, because you increased your debt to borrow. So you added more debt each time you're borrowing.
So you can't drink yourself sober?
I don't know of any case. It depends what you're drinking, I guess. You can drink yourself dead.
There you go. What would you tell a young person who is about to go into college in the next few weeks so that they don't fall into debt by predatory lenders who want to take advantage of them?
Just try not to borrow anything. Live within your means. And, do get a job. It doesn't hurt. It doesn't harm your grades. Get a part-time job while you're in school. But you have to learn. And you have to stop believing everything you hear. The first thing I want them to stop believing is that their government is no good and hopeless, because that hits them in a big way from a lot of different angles. First thing I want them to understand is that there are absolutely wonderful elements in our government working hard to change it and to fix it. They're alongside a lot of pigs and jerks and bad people, evil ones and crazy ones and so on. But the good ones are in there. And you don't disrespect that tremendous sacrifice or that tremendous gift that they're giving us by combining and pretending or thinking of them as all bad. That is destructive. The LaRusses love that. Other groups that are trying to undermine our society love that. You don't buy into that the government and society is evil. Don't do that. The society ultimately is a reflection of us, and we have to improve to the point where we understand our responsibilities toward the society, toward one another, toward the truth. And then those kids have a chance of moving forward. They have a chance of accomplishing something. And kids do not just think in terms of how much money are you going to make and how comfortable are you going to get and that type of thing. You should be looking forward to a life of achievement and a large degree of pleasure and self-fulfillment and helping our society improve. That is a key. That's what really counts. And the people who make a lot of money, what do they do? I mean, so what? So take Maxwell, for example, the guy who was thrown off or jumped off his huge yacht after stealing $400 or $600 million from the pension fund he was in charge of in the newspaper that he took over. These people, and to really be successful in terms of the paper chase game, there are things that you have to do that people shouldn't do. Not all the time. There are exceptions, of course. But as a rule, it's a disgusting type of activity. It's not fulfilling. And the kind of woman, if you're a man, the kind of woman you'll get as a result of all that cash, so what? It's not that important, So what kids have to know, they have to specifically learn about money and the financial system. So they should read my book. They really should. College age, no problem. My book's very understandable. If you've got a kid who's going into college, give them the book. Tell them to read a chapter every week or every month or whatever and talk to them about it. If they understand these things, they'll understand some of what we're talking about here. Now, something pretty important happened yesterday, Jan, and I'd like to tell your listeners about it.
Sure. What is that?
The Green Party faces real challenges, you know? In one sense, they have won, because today everything's got to be green, you know? Just look at advertisements in a magazine. They're selling green because everybody wants green. Philosophically, green has won. Politically, it has hardly gotten started at all. And part of the reason for that is that it's not allowed to operate without people who are there to destroy it. That's, I think, the case with most organized activities. If there's an activity that's organized and has a chance of achieving a degree of power, it's going to be monitored. There're going to be people in it, plants or whatever. It's the nature of society. There was a period in England where this occurred for over 100 years. I discuss it very briefly in my book in the section about Thorold Rogers and what happened to him and what he wrote about. I think it's in chapter 10 or 11, can't remember. And so likewise, in the Green Party, there are really wonderful ideas, and as you find this especially among the old-timers. And these are people who are now 75, 85, 87 years old. They found us, by the way, Jan. Two of them found us, really old-timers. And they could figure out what we were doing. They knew this was good. And they brought me in front of the National Convention of the Green Party in 2007 in Reading, Pennsylvania, and we gave a talk called Greening the Dollar, which was the name we figured was appropriate and really, really, really describes what we're trying to do. Well, it went over really, really well. And we continued to work with the Greens, and they learned from us, these old Greens, not so much the younger ones, okay? There's a problem with the youth in this country. And we continued working with them, and they actually formulated for us a single-page statement of my 736-page book, okay? Now, that fulfilled what the Congress told me when I first started going down there to talk about money back, 5 years ago, no, 6 years ago. The Congress people said, you know, they'd be holding my 736-page, 5-pound book in their hand, and they say, you need to get this down to one page. And, you know, I would laugh. Well, these Greens got it down to one page, less than a page, in terms of the reform proposal. And they made that a monetary reform plank. And they got it approved by their platform committee in 2008. And we were there in Chicago when they got that approved. And it was just beautiful. And I saw Cynthia McKinney, she was the candidate. I saw her father at the party the evening after that was put into the platform. And he was there with another guy that I couldn't understand what he was doing in the place. He looked like a Republican wearing a slick suit. I know his name. I'm not going to tell you. I know where he's from. But I saw him there together, so I figured, well, he's with Cynthia's dad. He must be okay. And I began and told both of them how important it was that such a monetary reform plank was now in the platform, and how historic this was, that never before, never in history, in human history, it's never been all put down what you have to do to fix the money system, the whole thing, in principle. Not all the details, it's one page. And I was so happy to see it, you know. Well, the very next day came time to pass the platform. And that very person spearheaded an attack on the whole platform for ostensibly another reason. And they sent Cynthia out on the campaign trail with the 2004 platform, believe it or not. Now, that highlights one of the problems with the Green Party. They've got some stupidity built in that it's going to take them some more years to correct, but they will get it correct, hopefully. And this, you know, we saw some of the old-timers there. They were just disgusted with this whole process and thinking of starting a new party. Well, that was the bad news, and I learned something from that. Well, here's the good news. Yesterday, the platform committee was working and working and working, and they have a system where they do it by email. And they make their decisions, and they carry on votes. Yesterday, the same good old Greens, and these are 87-year-old people, introduced that plank again, okay? And a character, I'm just going to call him a character, I know who it is and so on, began to agitate against it for stupid, no good reasons. And these two Greens, these two ancient Greens, they beat them off. They had a fight with them, and they won. So the 2012 Green Platform is going to have in it the best potential monetary reform plank that has ever been done, ever. And that's something that every Green can be proud of. And I'm not worried about mentioning it on the radio. It's not going to happen again. They're not going to send somebody out without a platform again. So that's the good news. It's coming from the old timers, Jan. How old are you?
Almost 40.
Oh, my God. You're one of the kids. One of the kids. Well, that's good. You're almost 40. Our assistant here, Jamie, what's your age?
38.
Only 38. It's important that you guys are here to carry this forward in case we don't get the whole thing done. Now, we've got a chance to get this done because the bankers, the economists, all these people have been so bad. They've given us the opportunity to get this done now through their, what's the word, through their piggishness. That doesn't begin to describe it. You know, through their horrible greed, and that doesn't begin.
Misanthropic.
What?
Misanthropic.
Misanthropic, yeah. Yeah, exactly. That's a good one. So that's the situation. And that brings us to another thought, okay? The character trying to assassinate this platform plank, putting forward, we'll fix this little thing, we'll fix that little thing, you know? Now, we are in a crisis point where you use this crisis that they've created to really fix the system. And this character was saying, sir, these guys are against state banking, and we don't know why. You know, my God, what nonsense. They're proposing the opposite of reform. They're proposing going 180 degrees against reform. True reform, any real monetary reformer knows, true reform requires ending the privilege that the banks have to create money. Now, that is done through what's called a fractional reserve system. And what these creepy, and I include the supposed good guys that are supposedly supporting it, who think they're progressives, these characters. They're proposing, instead of doing away with the fractional reserve system, they're proposing that every state start engaging in this criminal practice. It's not criminal because they legalize it. In this horrible, immoral, should-be criminal practice. So they're going 180 degrees against reform, and they justify it by saying, well, this is a step-by-step approach. Well, guys, step-by-step should be in the direction of reform, not against it. Is this too much for your people, Jan?
No, I think they'll be just fine.
Okay. I want your people to read the book. I want them to join with us in discussing it, because they'll have questions about it. They shouldn't be worried about asking those questions. And we do this on our blog, and we'll accept all kinds of any good question that comes from the heart and is real gets on there. We can recognize when questions are not real. We know that. We understand, and we see it repeated often by a few characters. That's not important. We love to discuss these things with normal, everyday people. And your people are invited, but they should read the book first. Sometimes I get emails and people are saying, explain this to me, explain that to me, explain this. And
Isn't that annoying when people ask you to explain something that you've already written a book about?
That's why you wrote the book, so they wouldn't have to ask you. So you wouldn't have to repeat it 1,000 times. You know, your time's worth something. It's like your sweat and blood is worth something, and you should be allowed to live. And when you put, and I know you work carefully, when you put hours and weeks and months and years into researching a particular topic in depth, and people don't understand that by getting one volume, they're getting the distilled lifetime of a person's experience and knowledge, a lifetime in a volume that they can read in a month. Now, if you're careful and you select volumes written by people who you think should be writing, who have something to say, that is going to be one of the most worthwhile activities you have. And I realized this early in going through the approximately 800 source materials that I had to go through in order to gain the knowledge that I felt comfortable with to write the book. And you learn when you gain a sense, a feeling, you can hear a ring of truth in an author. You really can. And when you find one of those guys, you just read that book slowly and you take notes. And that's what I did. And it's a wonderful feeling. And I used 300-year paper on this book because there are books where I was the last person to read them because they just disintegrated in my hands. One really good one by Del Mar. Anyway, I want to stress this is something that your people need to do. And this is something that we as an institute need to really ask them to do now. We just reprinted the book, of which you will get a nice, shiny new copy. We have these books ready to ship. We have paid for the printing already. It's important for the Institute to be moving these books from the boxes they're in now into the hands of Americans who can understand this problem and who can help to solve it.
Let's go back to your 24 case histories in your book for a moment.
Sure.
And
23
let's talk,
chapters.
Right. And the evolution of money and its influence on humanity over the past 6,000 years. I'm curious, since we live in a culture that deifies status quo economists like Milton Friedman and Alan Greenspan, et cetera.
Yeah.
How many case histories would I have to read to be on their level?
Oh, if you read my book carefully, you're way beyond them. Alan Greenspan was a klutz. I think that's the right word, isn't it? Klutz. C-L-U-T-Z. Alan Greenspan, I have to say this. You know, you're not supposed to say something unless it's positive. So here's the positive thing I can say about Alan Greenspan. At least he admitted he was wrong. Now, your people can find that admission on our homepage, which is at monetary.org. We have an article there of Alan Greenspan's statement that he was wrong and why he was wrong. That's important for people to read. They're trying to rejuvenate him. They're trying to reconstruct Alan Greenspan. Now, you see the articles. It can't be done. It won't be done. But just read what he admitted was his mistake. You know, he's not an evil figure with that nasal voice that he had. And, there was a time when he had so much chutzpah that he thought he could tell Congress anything. And there was one testimony that he gave where he said, at the end of it, he said, that's it, I'm paraphrasing now. And if you think you understood what I said, you're probably wrong. Now,
I think I've seen the video of that.
Yeah. That's when what should happen in that video at the end of it is that a giant hand should come out of the sky and grab him by the scruff of his neck and just yank him out of Washington. That's what should have happened. But the Congress was just too busy kissing Alan's behind. Why? Because the media was building him up. Why? Because the owners of the media were making millions and billions off of his errors. That's the real money game. We have to end it now. It's class warfare. It's not just class warfare. It's misanthropic. It's warfare against humanity. It's humanicide. I don't think they had that in the ancient days because they couldn't reach everybody.
Indeed.
Now they can. We must take back the money power back into the hands of our government, where we have a far superior chance to influence it and control it, and then we'll go step by step and we'll use Aristotle's method. That is, we'll learn by doing. And this has to be done now. Now's the time. The crisis is here. It's going to get worse now. It looks like we're going to have, down 27% housing sales over the year. Last year wasn't too good either. You know, this is not our country operating. Our country's in the hands of fiends. And Mr. Obama, the one great thing about Mr. Obama is a black guy finally got to be president. Wonderful. Great. But it seems to me that he's told himself, well, that's enough. Now I don't have to do anything else.
At this point, I'm starting to think he's worse than Bush.
No, never. Nobody's worse than Bush. Never forget, Bush is an international war criminal.
Okay. Well, I think they're all working for the Bilderbergers and the Trilateral Commission and that stuff.
No. They're really good people there. And part of Obama is really good. But he's allowed Larry Summers to stay in his administration. He's got this character as Secretary of the Treasury. He's got Rahm Emanuel as Chief of Staff, who determines who he sees and whether he sees anybody. He will not do well with those critters in his neighborhood. He's got to get rid of them. That'll be the first sign that Obama's getting serious, that those three guys are gone from the White House.
Well, I wouldn't bet on it.
Well, I'm hoping. I'm hoping that Obama can turn this presidency into a greater than Roosevelt president. He could. He really could. All he'd have to do is sit down and talk with me and the guy that trained him in Chicago for an hour. the guy who trained him in Chicago in street organizing, is in our group.
Who's that?
Oh, you can find out if you go to our website, monetary.org, and then click on the page that shows all the speakers at our upcoming conference, September 30th through October 3rd. He is one of our speakers, has been for the last 3 years. He's a philosopher, and you won't mistake him when you see him. And you'll see his background there. I'm not going to mention his name. Now, why don't I tell you a bit about the conference then?
Sure.
That be okay?
Sure.
This is our sixth annual Monetary Reform Conference. The Institute was founded, we're in our 14th or 15th year, we were founded in 1996. And we are a publicly supported charity. It's a 501c3 type, but it's called a publicly supported charity in particular, which means that that our funding comes from the sale of materials, you know, educational materials that we work with. It comes from, that means the book, means the conference, and it comes from donations. And the donations are an important part of what we do, and they have to be at a certain level to maintain that standing as a publicly supported charity, and they are easily within that amount. So we always appeal to people that we're reaching, that if you have a real job, send us a monthly amount. Arrange it with your bank to send us $50 a month, $75 a month. It's probably one of the, you know, if you can afford to do that, it's one of the best potential uses of your money. Now, if you're super rich, well, then this is a chance for you to make a difference with that money that might give a meaning to your life that you otherwise would never have had the opportunity. And you should consider that. But, you know, the people that listen to us are not super rich. So if you can arrange to send $25 a month through your bank, they'll do that. And we'll appreciate it much, very much. And that's what keeps us going, these donations. They really do.
Isn't it ironic, Steve, that you need money to reform money?
It is. But you really, in our society, you have to have that. Or you have to have volunteers, and we have volunteers. Jamie Walton is here from New Zealand. It'd be impossible to estimate what it would cost if he had to be paid. He couldn't be paid, right? Beyond payment. Volunteer understands that the importance of getting monetary reform in America is to New Zealand. You can't get it in New Zealand. They already had a better system than us and got turned in the wrong direction by the Hayek crowd and the Bank of England people. So he's here because he knows this is where it has to be changed, America. And so this is the best place to spend his time. We've got people who are working, who are part of the Department of Agriculture. They're helping us out. Part of our monetary reform is also to reform what's called a parity system, whereby farmers are enabled to hang on to their property because they become immune to the games that the financial people have been playing within the commodity markets. That's one thing that, you know, all this business of derivatives, they should not be allowed, whatever. You don't need derivatives. First, they've confused what that means. They've confused. They're calling derivatives what the old farm commodity contracts were. Now, technically, they're derivatives, but there's a difference. The financial derivatives are mechanisms of mass destruction, and they've turned them against the farmers in the last few years, driving prices incredibly high, causing the farmers to readjust their planting in anticipation, and then the prices come down, and what happens? These guys have to sell their land. To who? To the same, I don't want to swear on the air, but those are the terms that are coming to mind, to these horrible creatures. Jan, we have to use the law to deal with them. I don't advocate violence. I really don't. What we do has to be done through the law, and we always are advocating legal actions to deal with this stuff. But it's surprising to me that in this country of so many million farmers, that nobody hasn't taken one of these creeps down yet. I don't advocate that they do it. I really don't. Because chances are they'd mess it up and just become another reason to harm our country. It's easy to turn things around like that. And anyway, the guys that act violently are usually the nutcases like Timothy McVeigh, who do no good and just damage. So we do not advocate that. But you've got to do something through the law. And that's what we're doing. We've got an act that's ready to be introduced into the Congress, and we're expecting that it will be soon, we hope before our conference. But you never know how long that takes, because it's very difficult to introduce laws into the Congress. Very difficult. But we've been working at that for 5 years without pay.
Yeah, I should mention in regard to Timothy McVeigh, he repeated over and over that he didn't work alone. And in fact, historian Gore Vidal was in touch with Timothy McVeigh for several years before they put him to death, and he published the whole story.
You're kidding. Gore Vidal was in touch with him?
Oh, yeah. The book is called Perpetual War for Perpetual Peace.
That's Vidal's book.
Yes.
I have to read that. I've always had an interest in Vidal. He wrote about our area in upstate New York in his book about Burr and why Burr had to kill Hamilton, you know, the first central banker.
Right.
Yeah, Vidal is an interesting guy. Yeah. I have a photo on the wall here of his house in Italy.
Really?
Yeah, it's an incredible place, touching the sky, basically, on the mountains of Italy, overlooking the sea. It's like being on Capri at the palace on Capri.
Well, let me ask you this, Stephen.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with Jerry Muller's work over at the Catholic University of America?
No, I'm not.
He let me ask you this, because he just recently published a statement in a new book of his, not remembering the title right now. But he says, quote, "To the best of my knowledge, no intellectual historian has yet produced a history of the concept of usury.
Uh-huh.
But the man who has come closest, Herbert Luthy, noted of scholastic doctrine that, quote, like alchemy or astrological magic, it did not die."
Yeah. Well, you know what? I would really appreciate getting an email from you on that. We have found several really great works on usury. They're described in, this is another reason people need my book. They really do. There's a chapter on the scholastics, chapter 7. Scholastics were the Catholic people who knew more about everything in their day and had read everything that was available in their day. And they did a lot on money, and they held back usury in the West for a long time. And there are a couple of excellent books on the scholastics that we used extensively, and they're discussed in my book. One's by Noonan, the other's by, I can't remember the guy anyway. The name of the book was Interest and Usury, Dempsey. But the place to start is with the Lost Science of Money book. And, by the way, satisfaction is guaranteed, or people will be refunded their money. We also have at our website an extensive article on the history of usury. It was a speech I gave in London right after I gave a speech at the House of Lords in London in 04. And right afterwards, I gave a talk at Lord Sudley's club, Lord Sudley's Monday club. Lord Sudley is he's the anti-usury lord. And so I gave this talk there, and it's quite good. It's reprinted at our website, monetary.org. People just have to look all the way down the homepage, and I think they'll find that really very, very interesting. Now, there's something I should point out. The American Monetary Act, which is also at the website, it limits interest to 8% maximum per year, including all fees. And we do that because we know we can do it, because up until 1981, that was the limit in America. The states had, each state had a usury limit, and it was from 8 to 10%. Pardon me, from 6 to 10%. So we set 8% as a limit. And so we know it'll work. The economists will scream about it, but they're just jerks. Now, we do another thing there which is fascinating and is not so obvious. We end compound interest. And we do it in the following language, which is why it's not obvious, but it can happen. The language is, the amount of interest on any loan can never exceed the amount of the principal. That's an effective limit on compound interest. And it can pass in that form, except accepting mortgages, you know, which go for 30 years.
This is kind of a sort of different question, but okay. I was just pondering, if nations and groups of people, i.e. government, can print their own money, what would happen if individual people started printing their own money instead?
Well, it's not workable for everybody to create their own money.
Well, I mean, what if, you know, people just wrote down on a little piece of paper, because, you know, basically, you know, what I'm getting at is that if you go into a bank and you put your signature on a loan, you're creating that money. So couldn't people just create their own money anyway?
Well, you shouldn't be able to do that for the same reason that the bank shouldn't be able to do that. It's a social power. Money is best created by government and actually spent into circulation to create the things that the society needs. And that's what tends to happen if the money's created by government.
What would happen, though, because, if everybody created their own money?
I don't think it would work at all. I don't see it. It'd be worthless. It'd be the money that a rich person created or promised to pay something might have some value. That's moving backward away from a democratically powerful government to a system of oligarchy, or plutocracy. That you're moving to plutocracy. The money created by Coca-Cola and Pepsi-Cola and Coors beer would have value. Sorry to advertise Coors.
What if you only limit it to individual persons, though, and keep corporations out of the picture?
Well, this is same problem. Here's one thing that you got to understand, Jan. Fixing this money system is not as complicated as it's made out to be. But you got to just do those simple things, those three simple things. And what they are is, you put the money creator, Federal Reserve System, into the Treasury. Number one, you turn all the past credit that they've created into real money, which they then owe to the Treasury. And as their clients pay back the loans to the banks, they pay that over for that debt to the Treasury. That's the first step. That alone wouldn't work. You have to stop the banks from creating money. And that means you do away with what's called a fractional reserve system. And you insist that the banks are only allowed to loan real government money that's been deposited with them for loaning by their clients. Now, those two things alone wouldn't work, because you've taken away the power of the banks to create money and you haven't replaced it. And we know from history that that creates a deflation. So the third thing, the government, the Congress, has to be made specifically aware that they have the power to fund things that spend money into circulation for infrastructure, and within infrastructure, we include healthcare and we include education. That's it. It's that simple, Jan. Now, people who try to go into more complicated things are going to get lost there, and it's going to move them away from reform. do that reform first, and then if you need anything more, fine. I don't think you'll need anything more.
Except when you look at the work of, like, John Taylor Gatto or Charlotte Easterbeat, then you see a different problem that's proposed by the current education system and how that's used to enslave everybody and dumb people down.
Well.
And that needs to be completely reformed along with
Right, Jan. There are a dozen additional important reforms that are needed. We just stick with those three for the following reason. We know how much power we don't have. Right? So we have, and we know how powerful what we're up against is. So we just stuck with the three minimum reforms that will put time, or that can put time, on the side of justice. And then we've got time to work on these other things that have to be done, agreeably, that we agree must be done. But you can't bite them all off at once. Nothing will happen. That's our strategy, anyway. So you people can understand it. Now, please, Jan.
All right.
Tell them to support us by getting our book. Tell them to buy our book, to read it, to go onto our blog and communicate with us, to come.
How
to
about
the
you
conference.
Tell them that?
Oh, okay. I just did.
There you go. Well, let me ask Jan. You this: What is the single most important concept that you want people to take away from today's interview?
From today's interview, I'll give you more than one. The Greens did the right thing. Okay, that's important to know. So there's hope. The Greens have to be kept in line, same as Republicans and Democrats. You got characters amongst the Greens who are just as misled. So that's one thing to take away from this. Second thing to take away from this, we can win. We can win if we act. And we must act. If you don't act, what are you, a vegetable? You know, there's... They're not listening to your show if they're that type.
They're a positive thinker, I guess.
Yeah.
Without action.
Yeah. And another thing, we have these characters have been at war with us for hundreds of years. We have figured out how they did it. What's protected them in the past is people didn't figure it out. That's what your listeners can get from my book. They will understand what's going on. And there's nothing more powerful than that kind of knowledge. And we need them to support the Institute. We are out here doing all this work for nothing. Nobody gets paid, basically. And we have expenses that have to be met. Now, we've been doing this for 15 years. We just had to reprint our book, and we did it. We got it done. Big expense. We've got these wonderful new books for sale here. Please tell your listeners. Okay, Jan.
All right, Steve, and your website is monetary.org, and your title of your book is The Lost Science of Money.
Thank you, Jan. You do a great show there.
Thank you, Steve.
I hope it went well for your listeners.